Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw a line and give their attention to the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, thank you. You can be seated. Ms. Platt, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge Traxler. Good morning, and please the court. At the outset, I would like to apologize to the court, as I have already, to counsel for the Commonwealth and the United States for our oversight with the Rule 44B notice in the fall. Everyone has been very gracious, and we appreciate the patience of both the court and counsel. As the court knows, we're challenging the Virginia impersonation of a police officer statute on two independent First Amendment grounds. On one hand, the statute is void because it is overbroad, because it is written in the disjunctive rather than the conjunctive, as, for example, the federal impersonation statute is. The other ground is that the statute, similarly, is not narrowly tailored and accordingly fails strict scrutiny review. To start with that point, the statute is a content-based restriction on speech. It criminalizes, for example, myself walking up to the courtroom deputy and saying, "I am a police officer." As such, it is subject to strict scrutiny review. We squarely presented this argument in our brief, and neither the United States nor the Commonwealth has argued that the law is narrowly tailored. Rather, they have argued only that all false statements of fact are categorically unprotected by the First Amendment and therefore need not meet strict scrutiny review. They have failed to carry their burden to prove strict scrutiny if this court should determine that it does apply. This is the same argument that the United States presented to the Ninth Circuit in the Alvarez litigation. As we informed the court in a Rule 28J letter in October, Alvarez is pending before the Supreme Court. It will be argued on February 22nd. The Alvarez merits briefs are in the process of being filed. The first two have been filed, and they're publicly available. In Alvarez, the United States has actually stepped back from its argument that First Amendment, that all false statements of fact are unprotected as a categorical matter. The United States Solicitor General has not advanced that position in the Alvarez litigation. If you look at the United States merits brief in Alvarez, they're actually arguing for a lower standard of scrutiny that is not strict scrutiny, but is also not categorical unprotection. As a result, the United States is now taking inconsistent positions in this litigation as it is in Alvarez. Granted, it's a different subject statute being reviewed, but the First Amendment doctrine of strict scrutiny and false statements of fact it's the same doctrine. Because strict scrutiny in this case cannot be met, and because it is uncontested that Mr. Chappelle was convicted under the clause of the statute that forbids mere pretending.
In order for strict scrutiny to apply, you would first have to establish that there was a burden upon First Amendment right, wouldn't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And even though the statute is written in the disjunctive, who shall falsely assume or pretend to be any such officer, where is the communicative value in that?
Well, the communication, Your Honor, is that as in this case and as in this court's unpublished decision in Jackson and McGregor, the mere statement, speech, "I am a police officer," if untrue, subjects Mr. Chappelle to criminal liability.
Well, but you simply handed them a false ID.
He also stated that he was a Fairfax County deputy sheriff. In fact, he was a former Fairfax County deputy sheriff.
Well, but he had some documentary identification of that?
What he handed was his valid Virginia driver's license, which happened to show him in uniform. That's not illegal. It was his actual driver's license that he was forced, he had to show it by virtue of having been speeding on the parkway. He did not, for example, hand over a badge or any sort of false certification of status.
What's the limiting principle in your argument?
The limiting principle, Your Honor, is that it would be very easy to draft a statute that is narrowly tailored. For example, like Section 912 of Title 18 of the United States Code, which says, as we put in our brief, whoever falsely assumes or pretends to be an officer, et cetera, and acts as such. I mean, we concede that there is a very compelling interest in not having people falsely acting traffic stops, executing fake search warrants, you know, acting as a police officer without being a police officer. But for example, if you took, obviously lying is bad, but that's...
So you want us to strike the statute down on its face?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the invalidating a statute on grounds of facial invalidity, haven't we been told numerous times by the Supreme Court not to take that sweeping a view?
It's certainly an uncommon action, Your Honor, but it's within the power of this court to so do.
Can we agree on the fact that it's disfavored?
It's disfavored when there are other alternatives that comport with the First Amendment, or whichever amendment is at stake here, the First Amendment. The Commonwealth of Virginia, and I believe the United States, have asked this court to imply an intent to deceive or other fraudulent mens rea or scienter requirement in the statute. But as the Supreme Court held in the Stevens case just in 2010, in order to construe a statute as such, it has to be, the language of the statute has to be susceptible to that interpretation. As we listed in our response brief to the Commonwealth of Virginia's brief, I've looked at all 50 states' impersonation statutes. My counting is, some of them have different subsections that have different punishments depending on which way you violate it. Less than 10 states prohibit the mere pretending to be a police officer as the Virginia statute does. Somewhere around 14 states have a similar requirement to the federal statute where you have to both pretend to be a police officer and act as a police officer to falsely exercise the power of a police officer, which Mr. Chappelle did not do. 20-something other states have various versions of a fraudulent scienter requirement. There's a number of different ways they've done it. Some of them have intent to induce another to submit to a show of authority. There's intent to induce reliance. There's intent to facilitate a felony. There's a number of different ways that the states have done this. None of them can be read into the Virginia statute, which simply says assume or pretend to be. The word falsely is redundant, actually, because if you look at pretend or assume, both of them imply that you are necessarily not what you are. I mean, an actor on stage does not become a police officer by virtue of being an actor. He is falsely pretending to be an officer. Now, he does not have an intent to defraud, but he is falsely pretending to do that. That word is not enough to imply fraudulent. Now, if it said fraudulently, that would be an entirely different statute, but that's not what our friends across the street in the legislature have done. As I said, the fix for them would be very easy. They could either pick one of these fraudulent scienter or mens rea requirements, as so many other states have done, or they could follow the federal statute and that of 14 other states that require action as a police officer, which is not at issue in this case.
The government seems to indicate that the word false itself, and I know you alluded to this from the beginning, but that you can import or at least pull from that there is an intent element that is added to the statute by using the word false.
That is what they are asking the court to do, but they haven't provided any examples of the word falsely being used to imply fraudulent intent. I mean, falsely just means, false means not true. So again, somebody who, like a young man who's trying wrongly to impress his girlfriend's parents and says, instead of saying, I'm a night watchman or I'm a mall security officer, says, I'm a police officer. That person on his face is falsely representing to be a police officer to his girlfriend's parents, and he has violated the Virginia statute and can be convicted of a Class 1 misdemeanor. I mean, it's up to 12 months in jail at issue, not in this case, but as a matter of potential liability under the statute. And again,
is it a maxim of statutory interpretation? I wouldn't carry it too far to the point where the words would not support it. My colleague Judge Wynn has written a very interesting opinion on this earlier about the dangers of carrying limiting constructions too far. As a general interpretive maxim, aren't we to interpret statutes in an effort to save their constitutionality rather than to overturn them? And the courts can and do adopt limiting constructions on statutes, and the question is whether the wording would support the limiting instruction, and the word falsely would seem to quite plausibly encompass a mens rea element, and wondering if that would be a great, much preferable to striking down a statute as a state statute is as facially invalid as a way to save it and have it reflect an intent requirement.
Yes, Your Honor, that is an option that this court has. The court has accurately stated the statement. I'm looking at the Stevens decision from the Supreme Court. Indeed, ambiguous statutory language should be construed to avoid serious constitutional doubts. I would disagree with the court that the word falsely is ambiguous. False means not true, and it is not a synonym of fraudulent. And as I indicated earlier, courts may impose a limiting construction on a statute only if it is readily susceptible to such a construction. And we will not rewrite a law to conform to constitutional requirements. I would submit that using the word falsely to imply some kind of fraudulent mens rea or other fraudulent element is not within the plain language of the statute. I would add, though, that if the court is so inclined, it would still be best to vacate Mr. Chappelle's conviction and remand because, as I indicated, there are 20-something states that have a variety. I mean, I think it's at a minimum of 5 different fraudulent elements that they've added to their statutes, and depending on which one the court chose, it could be that that Mr. Chappelle's actions did not violate the statute. So if this court were to rewrite the Virginia statute to avoid a constitutional problem, I would ask the court to remand to the district court so that the district court could determine in the first instance whether my client's behavior fell afoul of the court's newly imposed or newly recognized scienter requirement, because it would not be clear on the record that he had. It was, Your Honor. We waived our right to a jury trial.
What you're suggesting to us that in view of the limiting instruction, we could remand for trial as to whether the facts here actually indicated some knowing falsity or
depending on, again, which, if you, for example, if the court were to impose the fraudulent element of intent to induce another to submit to authority, which several states have as in their impersonation statutes, I don't think that the facts of this case would meet that. There are, you know, there's a number of different fraudulent elements that you could import, and depending on which one, this is why I would submit that that's a better decision for the legislature to make, because there are a number of options that would limit the statute. They're not all the same, and that would make it consistent with the First Amendment.
But also there's a value in respecting the legislature's intent, when not to take its handiwork and just strike it down across the board.
I think that could cut both ways, Your Honors. I agree that I'm sure the legislature would prefer not to be subject to judicial review. That said, there's also a respect for the legislature.
That's not in the parameters of what we're talking about, just not subjecting statutes to judicial review.
But I think, Your Honor, that it would also show respect to the legislature to let them choose which fraudulent mens rea requirement, or for that matter, to choose the action requirement of the federal statute, and like I said, that 14 other states have. I mean, it's a legislative determination how it is that they would like to limit the statute if this court agrees. And again, the parties have not argued that the statute is narrowly tailored. The limiting construction, I think, was made in the context of the overbreadth argument, which is a separate doctrinal argument. The government, neither sovereign, has even attempted to meet its burden to show that the statute as written is narrowly tailored. They have argued only that false statements of fact are categorically unprotected, a question, as I said, that is pending in Alvarez, and which the United States is no longer advancing in that separate litigation.
The clause that you seek to challenge here is the one that says, who shall falsely assume or presume to be any such officer. If we were to rule in your favor, would that essentially leave the rest of the statute intact?
I think this court could decide that clause is severable and leave the first, the action, or the exercising the authority clause intact. I think that's definitely, it's an easily severable clause in my view. I see my time has expired if the court doesn't have further
questions.
You've
got some time reserved. Let's hear from Ms. Mickelson.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jamie Mickelson, Assistant United States Attorney on behalf of the United States in this matter. Your Honor, this court should affirm the defendant's conviction because the Virginia statute at issue is not unconstitutional, as both the magistrate judge and the district judge have already correctly determined in this case. As the appellant noted, there are two primary issues. The first is whether the statute is overbroad to create a First Amendment problem. The second is whether the statute is subject to strict scrutiny review, an issue which I think the appellant jumps over and does not address. Finally, whether it would actually survive strict scrutiny review if the court were to find that it were subject to that. I will turn first to the overbreadth analysis. As Judge Wilkinson pointed out, striking down a statute on overbreadth grounds is disfavored. I would agree that it's disfavored and that it should be the last resort for this court. As the court knows, an overbreadth analysis says that a law that restricts speech may be invalidated as overbroad only if a substantial number of its applications are unconstitutional, and that's judged in relation to the statute's plainly legitimate sweep. And I think that that's an issue that the appellant fails to address here, is the plainly legitimate sweep of this statute. There's really no argument that the government has, that there's a plainly legitimate sweep and that the government has a compelling interest in preventing persons who are not law enforcement officers from acting as law enforcement officers. And whether that means that they actually—
You say compelling interest, you're not conceding that there's strict scrutiny?
I'm not, Your Honor. But I think those two ideas go hand in hand. The plainly legitimate sweep of the statute is very broad, and I think that's because the government has the compelling interest in preventing non-law enforcement officers from acting as law enforcement officers. And it has that interest whether the person actually attempts to use that authority or whether they simply say that they are law enforcement officers.
In the determination of the overbreadth of it, it seems that the inquiry goes to where essentially can this go? So there's been some indication, a strong indication, you can assert rights of others in that particular vein. And I'm trying to understand in terms of that particular clause, and I think it's just the clause. I think you agree that the one who shall falsely assume or pretend to be any such officer, that in and of itself is all you need. That applies to a lot of situations, a lot of very innocent situations. And certainly we don't want it to apply to cops and robbers, kids playing. We don't want it to apply to a costume party or to a Halloween situation. And while those things sound absurd, they surely apply.
Certainly. I think there's two responses to that. The first is that no court, that case has never been brought, and no court has ever found that it would be. And in the absence of any Virginia court ever finding that that kind of conduct would actually violate the statute, I don't believe that it's this court's place to decide that a Virginia court would in fact interpret the statute.
But I don't think that's the law, is it? I mean, not that a court has actually found it. The question is whether it is overbroad in that sense.
It's not, but the person who claiming overbreadth bears the burden of demonstrating that overbreadth does actually exist. And so I think that it weighs in, that's something that the court should consider, is that a case like that has never been brought. And as I think that my colleague from Virginia would argue, the Virginia court would not be likely to find that that kind of conduct would violate the statute. And that leads
to, you know, in the normal course of things, you don't want a person impersonating an officer. Clearly, a state should be able to prohibit a person impersonating an officer going to someone's house and saying, I'm an officer, and searching the house or doing something of that nature. What we have here is somewhere in between. I'm trying to understand exactly what the import of it is, because this individual indicates to a police officer who stopped him for speeding or something of that sort and says, I'm an officer. Well, he very well could say, so what? Of course, I think the common knowledge is, the common thought is that if you're a police officer, you may get a courtesy and get a pass on it. But that's nothing legal about that. That's something that's personal in terms of that.
Right.
In terms of the legal import of saying, I'm a police officer, I mean, that's pretending.
Well,
if you go to your neighbor and just says, I'm a police officer, and just for fun. Whatever. What's the import of it? Once he hears I'm a police officer, the response should be, so what? You got a ticket. I'm giving it to you. End of story.
And I agree that's what should happen here, but I think the problem is that if this person says to an actual police officer, I am a police officer, and he gets away with saying that, then what's to stop him from saying to his neighbor, I am a police officer? And then that person...
I'm dealing with this case in which he just says, I'm a police officer, and, you know, pulls out whatever, and I guess he's been one in the past, he's just not one now. And, you know, what we derive from that is that, well, the purpose of him doing this is so that he can get out of this ticket. But the officer who issues the ticket, the fact he's a police officer ought to be irrelevant. I mean, he's speeding, and he's not indicated I'm in the course of working or scope of my duties. I'm a police officer. Well, so what? I'm president of the United States. So what? You're not going to get off this ticket. Here's your ticket. Have a nice day.
I agree with that, but I believe that it's broader than that. I think the problem lies in allowing people to falsely claim that they are police officers, because we are taught in society to trust someone because by the mere fact that they are wearing a police uniform, that they're driving a police car, or that they say, I am a police officer. We teach young children, if you see a police officer, you can trust that person, and that's somebody that you know. And so if we allow people to go around saying, I am a police officer, and doing it as an intentional misstatement of fact, as it was in this case, there's no question that the appellant thought that he was still a police officer. And I don't think that that's
this
a concern.
Is looking to, you're assuming even if it's immediate scrutiny or the strict scrutiny in terms of the state's interest in this.
Exactly.
Is to not allow a person to say, I'm a police officer in general. You just can't do it.
It does, because I think that it undermines the credibility of police officers in general. And part of the reason that our justice system and our law enforcement system is effective is because people trust that if someone says to them, I am a police officer, that is in fact the truth and that they can rely on that. If instead what the court says is people who are not law enforcement officers can go around and falsely claim that as a matter of fact they are law enforcement officers when they are not, then what's to stop someone from wearing a police uniform, walking around in a police uniform, and people see that person?
You have, there's fair notice here, and obviously your statute encompasses a lot of it has a plainly legitimate sweep on it. What do you say then about the word falsely, and whether there needs to be some mens rea element, and whether falsely adequately expresses a mens rea element?
Certainly. As the court knows, in the absence of some evidence that Congress did not, or the state legislator did not intend to impose a mens rea requirement, it's assumed that there is some mens rea requirement in a criminal statute. Secondly, as Your Honor already addressed, the court should construe a statute in a way that would avoid an unconstitutional reading if it's possible to do that.
So if we assume that a criminal statute in the normal construction is that there is a mens rea element, what is the mens rea element? Is it willfully or knowingly or what?
I believe it would be knowingly in this instance, and that's because of the use of the word falsely. Under the appellant's reading, if all that we're punishing is pretending to be a law enforcement officer, then falsely would be a redundant word. And the court should also construe statutes, should assume that the legislature put in the word falsely intentionally and that that word has some significance. So, for example, a child playing cops and robbers is merely pretending.
Well, your view is that a false representation would not normally be assumed in a criminal statute to be unknowing.
Correct, exactly. In this case, someone cannot be falsely pretending to be a law enforcement officer if they're not knowingly claiming as a matter of fact to be a police, to be an actual police officer. I think that's where the difference hinges, is a Halloween party goer or a child playing cops and robbers is merely pretending. They aren't falsely pretending to be a police officer.
It's not true.
I'm sorry?
Not true. He's not a cop.
He's pretending to be a police officer.
Oh, it's false.
He's not falsely assuming to be an actual police officer.
Well, I think you're trying to import this whole business of intent to defraud into the statute. And that would be all well and good, but that's not what we do as a court. We let those guys, as they say, across the street do that. I mean, and it doesn't take much to write a statute the way it needs to be written.
Correct.
But it clearly he's not telling the truth. Even a kid that's playing cops and robberies, is false. It's like Santa Claus. It's false. I mean, it may be harmlessly false, but it's false. But he's pretended.
That's correct, but he's not pretending to be a police officer as indicated under this statute. He is not pretending to be a Virginia state trooper or a Richmond police detective.
This thing says falsely assume or pretend to be any such officer. It doesn't matter if you pretend to be an officer in any context, whether it's playing cops and robbers on the front lawn or trainees at a police academy who have not yet become policemen yet, or people in the costumes at a Halloween, if you go in and you pretend to be an officer and you go in and says, I'm arresting you or whatever?
No, they certainly are pretending to be, and I think that's where the importance of the word falsely comes in. They are not falsely pretending to be an actual police officer. That is make-believe, and that is, first of all, as I pointed out earlier, I don't believe a situation that a Virginia court...
The question also is, you have to construe falsely in conjunction with pretend.
Correct.
But the question in all these facial overbreadth doctrines is whether somebody who's plainly within the statute's legitimate sweep even has standing to raise the claim of somebody on the periphery, because you can always conceive of some hypothetical little children playing. You can always conceive of some hypothetical that involves, innocent behavior. I mean, there's a Halloween party where somebody wears the police costume and then there are children playing cops and robbers and everything. Hasn't the Supreme Court said that someone who's within the scope of the statute's legitimate sweep doesn't have standing to assert some hypothetical which is way out on the periphery of a statute, that what you do is you wait until the statute is actually applied to some child that's going to a Halloween party. So far as I know, the statute has not been applied to someone going to a Halloween party. If it is, that defendant can raise that application and have it struck down. But we would be toppling statutes right and left if every conceivable hypothetical sufficed to strike down the statute as facially vague or overbroad.
I see that my time is up. If I could address the court's question.
Yes.
I think that's correct. The first part is that's exactly the hypotheticals that were raised by the appellant in the Perlman case, which is another Ninth Circuit case addressing a different prong of the same statute that was addressed under Alvarez. And it was decided after Alvarez, and the court held in that one that where the appellant raised the exact same issues. Somebody could be punished, an actor in a movie could be punished for falsely wearing a Medal of Honor. Somebody, a grandchild of a who was wearing his grandparents' Medal of Honor could be punished. And the court said that the mere fact you can conceive of examples like that is not enough. The second part is that the defendant's actions in this case clearly did violate the statute. It was not a matter of him simply saying, I am a police officer. He stated he was a police officer. He then handed over his driver's license, which was a legitimate driver's license, but pointed out to the officer in furtherance of his false statement, I'm wearing my uniform in that picture, see? He then, upon the officer's request...
Is there any real question as to mens rea in this particular case?
I don't believe that there is, because there's both the appellant's conduct and his speech at issue here. He went on to make up a false employee identification number.
Should we await a case where mens rea is at issue in order to address this question?
It certainly, I think, would give more guidance to the court to see whether a Virginia court would, in fact, determine.
Why do you say that there's no mens rea, at issue in this case?
Because both the appellant's speech and his conduct indicate that he knew he was not a law enforcement officer anymore. That's clear and that's agreed by the parties. Secondly is that he not only on one occasion, but he said that he was a police officer, which was not true, and then took steps through his actions and through further speech to reiterate to the officer that he was a police officer. I think it raises the inference that Judge Wynn indicated, which is that he was trying to get out of this speeding ticket by claiming that he was an officer. But there's no question that he knew he was not an officer, that he knowingly...
Judge Brinkema make findings to that effect?
I don't believe Judge Brinkema addressed the mens rea issue specifically because it was not raised in front of her.
Was that issue even raised at trial?
It was not to, based on my recollection of the record, it was not raised at trial, no.
Is it waived?
It would be waived. It would be waived if it had not been raised in front of Judge Brinkman.
What's this? Is it waived?
I believe it would be. If it was raised, it was not raised in a way that that is coming to mind my mind right now, based on my current recollection of the record.
Was it brought before the trial court? Was it raised as a defense to the trial court that the statute lacked a mens rea element?
I don't believe that it was. I believe the only issue before Judge Brinkman was the First Amendment challenge to the statute.
And that's the constitutional aspect of it. In order to meet that, you would have to have at least something there than just pretense, as you say.
Correct.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know how you avoid not having it there. Let me ask you, before you say it, one question. The next statute Virginia has an EMT statute, has all that defrauding business in there. It would make this statute good. So it's no question Virginia knows how to write these statutes to do it, but I'm puzzled as to why they would write this clause here.
Your Honor,
it has this very broad application.
I believe it's very broad, but I believe it's broad because of the compelling government interest in prohibiting this kind of behavior that I was speaking of before. And I believe it's also the reason that the Virginia statute is broader than the federal statute, because the interest in preventing, our federal agents are different. They don't walk around generally in uniforms identifying them easily as such, whereas our local law enforcement and our state law enforcement, the mere fact of saying that I am a police officer, the presence of someone in uniform or driving a car on the scene indicates that they have some sort of authority and some sort of trust. And in order to maintain that authority and to maintain the public's trust in law enforcement and maintain the public's trust that if someone says they are a law enforcement officer, that's a truthful statement, the Virginia statute necessarily has to be broader in order to protect those interests. And so I think that I agree with the court that it's broader, but I think that that's intentionally so. And I think it's done to protect the compelling government interest at issue.
All right.
Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Getchell.
May it please the court, Duncan Getchell for Virginia. I think we have to start with the proposition that Mr. Douglas Chappelle was clearly within the legitimate sweep of the statute, because you can't argue overbreadth under the First Amendment without making that concession. What you're seeking to do is to raise the rights of others. So, and it's clearly true that he should have conceded, as he did by waiver, that he was within the legitimate sweep.
And you say he cannot raise the rights of others?
I'm saying he can't here because of well-known limitations on the overbreath doctrine.
But in general, I'm asking under the Supreme Court law that you are saying that a person who has challenged the constitutionality of this statute cannot, in an overbreath argument, assert that a third party would be affected in some sort of a way that would be overbroad.
Under Virginia,
is that what you're saying?
Yes. Under Virginia versus Hicks, for example, you have to show both the text and from actual examples that people who are not within the legitimate sweep of the statute are being chilled. And this is all a hypothetical argument based solely on the text of the statute.
But your basic argument is the Supreme Court has indicated that striking statutes down on facial grounds, whether it be facially overbroad or facially vague, is really disfavored. And that what we should do is wait for a serious case where there is an arguably unconstitutional application before entertaining these sorts of challenges. You know, you go at statutes on an as-applied basis, and that you await what's arguably an unconstitutional application.
I agree with that entirely.
But, and then the follow-up question I have on this, I want to know whether the question was the question of falsely not being sufficient to convey a mens rea was raised at trial. Was it raised at trial?
I don't think that it was, because he didn't contest that he fell within the sweep of the statute. He tried to raise the rights of others. I don't remember anything from the short record that's in the joint appendix where this was presented in a way the court would know it was being presented.
Is there any question that He knowingly misrepresented himself to be a current employee of the force?
None whatsoever. I mean, it's clearly dangerous for somebody to try to persuade a stop officer that you're part of the guild. And Virginia can punish both a successful attempt or a mere attempt. And so nobody at trial was contesting that he was guilty under the statute. What they were trying to do was to say the statute was unconstitutional. And let's look at their theory, because I think they're bound by their theory in their brief. They are trying to argue that the statute should be construed make the words pretend and assume mean the dictionary definition represent fictitiously in play or make-believe. And no Virginia court would adopt that construction of the statute because of the rule of lenity that applies to criminal statutes, because the purpose of the legislature was obviously not to reprobate play or cops and robbers, and because of the a rule of constitutional avoidance. I mean, you'd have to construe the statute unnaturally in order to set up the constitutional challenge, which is the inverse of the rule of constitutional avoidance. So what they have is, with respect to the claimed overbreath based on the text, a forced and unnatural reading of the statute. And then with respect to the second element that's necessary in order to raise overbreath, that is that it's actually chilling some protected conduct, they have nothing but speculation and surmise. So I think that this is a classic case where the court would not allow the rights of imaginary third parties to be asserted, because this is really not a very serious challenge to the constitutionality of an otherwise clearly valid statute.
But there could be down the road.
If someone wished to adopt that forced and unnatural construction and arrest somebody who was wearing a police suit to a play or a party, you're right.
I mean, I don't think, I hear you when you're saying there's no mens rea at issue here, but what I'm saying is somebody could mistakenly, you take the case of a mistake, mistakenly pull out something that led an officer to believe that he was a police officer or whatever, and the thing comes to trial, and somebody says, "Well, I didn't mean to do this," and I think you wouldn't you not have a live constitutional question at that point?
I would think you would have an acquittal, because I think that the falsely.
You would have what?
Okay. An acquittal, because I think the falsely language would shield somebody who pulled out an ID by mistake, because I don't think he had falsely pretended or assumed. But yes, if somebody got convicted on that set of facts, they would be the proper party to challenge it constitutionally, not Mr. Chappelle. And I would also point out that on their direct attack, that this has to be narrowly tailored, this is codified with fraud, other fraud statutes. It's a species of fraud. It was a clear attempt to actually try to persuade the stop officers that Mr. Chappelle was an officer.
If we were to hold that there was a First Amendment interest in impersonating a police officer and in falsely impersonating a police officer, I guess we would have to find some communicative value in that. And I don't know what the limiting principle would be, because it would be, I guess, if there was a First Amendment interest in identity theft of all kinds. In other words, I don't know how we would get necessarily to strict scrutiny here without we'd be saying, I guess, that assuming any false identity is a communicative right and entitled to First Amendment protection. That's pretty broad. But that's where we'd go with this, isn't it?
That's where you'd have to go. The fact of the matter is that for historically, the Supreme Court has made it clear that fraud is an exception to First Amendment protection, that it has no...
Well, we have this we have this case before the Supreme Court now, the Stolen Valor case, which you're aware of. How would the Stolen Valor case impact this particular litigation?
Virginia intervened in this case when it became aware of it, precisely because we didn't want to make the Alvarez argument. We think that this statute can be more narrowly defended in the way that I have attempted to do so here today. It's no part of our showing that every false statement is constitutionally punishable, but what we're saying is that a species of fraud is, and that's what we have here.
And you get defrauded by what you say is the word false.
By seriously trying to persuade the stop officers that he's a member of the guild.
I'm talking about the statute. I'm looking at the statute. I mean, if we look at every situation and try to fit it within, yeah, you probably could get there, but the statute has to criminalize the conduct. And if it says falsely pretend, where do you get the fraud from that?
Well, I get the fraud from the actual conduct of Mr. Chappelle trying to get these police officers.
But he would be guilty of a statute that made defrauding it wrong.
And this,
I'm trying to find out where is the statute that says that defrauding, that is defrauding. This is falsely pretend.
I think,
unless you say that's defrauding.
The falsely pretend means to be pretending to be a real police officer, not a make-believe police officer, and that itself is a species of fraud. The mens rea is there in the falsely, and I think that this is a clear, legitimate sweep case for Mr. Chappelle, and if he wins, he has to win it all on overbreadth, and he can't show that the text should be interpreted to mean make-believe police officers, and he can't show that anybody's ever been prosecuted.
Before you said, I just need clarification on this, and that is the Supreme Court in Munson has said that an individual who brings an overbroad claim may assert those rights of another without the regard of the ability of the other to assert his own right, and with no requirement that the person making the attack demonstrate his own conduct could not be regulated by the statute.
I agree completely.
So how is it that you say you got to look at his specific conduct here, and he can't assert that others would be put in a position here where this statute would be overbroad?
As Judge Wilkinson noted, you can't just make up a hypothetical of some possible extreme reading of the statute. And then
I'm not a hypothetical, I'm only reading the Munson case. And the Munson case says that you can assert the rights of another. It may be hypothetical. The rights of another is hypothetical in every case because there is no justiciable cause or no nothing in controversy. The rights of another is a hypothetical, that if you, this person who was doing something here that would be overbroad, and that's covered here, he can assert those rights.
He can't assert those rights under Virginia versus Hicks unless, in addition to the supposition that third-party rights are being chilled, he has to make some showing that they're actually being chilled. Here, the third-party right that's supposedly being chilled is innocently pretending to be a police officer, and there's been no showing whatsoever that anybody's being prosecuted or chilled in their conduct by pretending to be a police officer innocently.
Thank you, Mr. Gatchel. Ms. Platt.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start with a narrow point. Virginia is trying to defend this statute and say it's not subject to strict scrutiny because it's a subset of fraud based on the fraud heading in the statute. We have case law against that, which we cited in our response brief to Virginia, but I've also become aware of a Virginia statute that says, it's section 1-217, the headlines of the sections printed in blackface type are intended as mere catchwords to indicate the contents of the sections.
Ms. Platt.
Yes.
I can't hear as fast as you talk.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You slow down just a little
bit. Of course, Your Honor. I apologize. The headlines of the sections printed in blackface type are intended as mere catchwords to indicate the contents of the sections and do not constitute part of the act of the General Assembly. Accordingly, the fact that this statute is codified under fraud is entirely irrelevant.
May I ask where you raised this idea that falsely didn't that falsely didn't incorporate a sufficiently a mens rea?
Your Honor, we argued that the statute is facially invalid under the First Amendment because it is not narrowly tailored and because it's overbroad.
I know you argued that. I'm asking about the particular argument that's come before us today as to whether the falsehood didn't imply knowing falsehood.
That is part of the narrowly tailored and overbreadth argument, Your Honor, because I think the government is now asserting.
No, but could you read to me where you raised that point?
We didn't raise it because the government is only arguing it now, Your Honor.
As what?
The government is now raising it, not us. Our argument is the same as it has always been. This statute is not narrowly tailored.
Where did you give the district court a chance to rule on your question about whether it's right or wrong? There's a waiver question here. Where did you bring it to the attention of the district court that you thought falsehood or falsely pretend did not mean knowing?
On JA page 115, we argued to the court that the statute is not narrowly tailored.
All right, would you read, because you know, all of the federal rules require that legal arguments and objections be raised with some specificity. And
yes, sir.
So would you read me the excerpt from the record that you say adequately raised the question?
The question we're arguing is whether the law is narrowly tailored. No, this mens rea question, Your Honor, is being raised by you.
What?
You're asking about the mens rea question. We are arguing narrow tailoring primarily and overbreadth as well.
I think you're the one that's raising it now, because you're saying that falsehood and pretend lacks mens rea argument. That's what you've been arguing before.
So it's
a mens rea element.
It's not narrowly tailored. That is our primary argument, Your Honor.
The reason it's not narrowly tailored, in your view, is because it lacks a sufficient mens rea element.
Because it's not a fraud statute. That's correct, Your Honor.
And I want to know where that argument was brought before the district court with some precision.
Well, the argument in the district court, Your Honor, was that the statute is not narrowly tailored because on its face.
But that's why. You have to ask why.
Because on its face, it says pretend or assume, falsely pretend or assume. It all is based on the plain language of the statute, all of which is in our pleadings below, Your Honor, both at the magistrate level and at the district court level. If I could quickly, as Judge Wynn has indicated, Your Honor is talking in the overbreadth argument, and I still, by the way, do not understand the counsel to have addressed the narrowly tailored argument other than to say that strict scrutiny just doesn't apply because it's fraud, a proposition with which we disagree. Your Honor has talked about the standard for void for vagueness and due process challenges, and that you cannot raise the rights of third parties. As Judge Wynn indicated, overbreadth is an exception to that rule. This is in Stevens on page 1587. Overbreadth is a second type of facial challenge, which does not involve a prohibition on raising the rights of third parties. With regard to the fact that no one has ever been prosecuted for lying to his girlfriend's parents or playing cops and robbers on the lawn, Your Honor, in Stevens, the recent overbreadth case from the Supreme Court about the animal cruelty videos, they relied on hunting magazines, legitimate, widely disseminated hunting magazines, just as there are many people who pretend to be police officers, whether in a personal situation like impressing someone's parents or whether in children theatrical productions. No one in Stevens had been prosecuted for disseminating a hunting magazine. We do not need to show that someone has actually been prosecuted for one of these hypothetical situations. In Stevens, that was not the case, and the Supreme Court still struck down the statute on the grounds of overbreadth. The Third Circuit had used strict scrutiny, showing that these two doctrines can be applied in the same case. Here, the government still has not argued that the law is narrowly tailored. They have argued only that it's fraud, which I think we've demonstrated it is not, Your Honor. Finally, I would argue that implying a mens rea of knowingly, as Your Honor has suggested, does not fix the narrow tailoring problem. I think you actually have to imply an element of fraud. Fraud, as you know, includes not only knowing falsity, but materiality and reliance and reasonable reliance by the victim. In this case, as Judge Wynn noted, there is no materiality because it should not be material to a police officer that you are a police officer when you get a speeding ticket. So on those grounds, both strict scrutiny and overbreadth, which are independent arguments, we would ask the court to vacate Mr. Chappelle's conviction.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into the last case.